Thank you, Your Honors. Good afternoon. My name is Alice Robbins, and my registration number is 33319. And I am here on behalf of Mr. Brookins, the appellant. Your Honors, today we are asking this court to overturn the denial of our request for Rule 60B3 relief. It is our contention that Mrs. Brookins failed to revive part of the judgment within the 20-year time frame as required by CRS 1410.122.1c and Rule 54H. Thus, those amounts should be deducted from the total money judgment amount. The verified entry of support was from 1977 to 2007. It should have been from 1987 to 2007. That is what we are asking the court today. Your Honor, as I reviewed the appellee's brief and reviewed our briefs, it appears to me that the real issue here is whether the 20-year time for revival of a support judgment starts running on the date an installment of support becomes a final money judgment, or at the time a verified entry of judgment is entered for purposes of enforcement. Your Honor, it is our It is our contention that the plain language of 1410.122.1c indicates very clearly that the time for the running of the 20-year time for revival is at the time each installment matures or accrues, which means that it starts running when a installment is due and is not paid. And the language says that. In brief review of that statute, basically, unsupport money judgments become final money judgments when they are due and not paid. There is no court action required. To enforce the support judgment, the statute says and instructs one to file the verified entry of support judgment for the period specified. Then the statute goes on to say the filing of a verified entry of support judgment shall revive all individual payments that have not been satisfied pursuant to Rule 54H. The statute specifically has that language. Rule 54H gives the procedure for reviving a judgment and states that a revived judgment must be entered within 20 years after the entry of the judgment which it revives. Your Honors, and I have to, this is my first time arguing, I forgot to reserve 3 minutes. Is it okay if I still reserve?
Just when you want to stop, you just stop.
Okay, thank you. Your Honors, the case law that's addressed this issue, we believe, fully supports our contention that the 20-year timing, the statutory time period for revival of support judgment begins at the time each installment becomes a final money judgment. I cited several cases. We go back to the Colorado Supreme Court case, Houck v. Smith, and while the statute may have been different at that time or not existed, the rule was still the same, and the Colorado Supreme Court first stated that 20-year statute of limitations for judgments applies to support judgments. The court also said that because the wife had filed 27 years after
Are you arguing this is a statute of limitations? The 20 years?
Actually, Your Honor, I'm not arguing that it's a statute of limitations. What we are arguing is, and just to clarify, statute of limitations is an affirmative defense. It doesn't deprive the court of jurisdiction. It deprives a plaintiff of a remedy because of an expiration of time. In our circumstance, under 1352.102.2a, which is a statute that relates to execution of judgments, it states very clearly that any judgment that has not been revived within the 20-year time period for enforcement of judgments is deemed satisfied. That is a statute, and we contend that is deemed satisfied as a matter of law. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question directly, but I think that the statute on enforcement of judgments clearly spells out what we're talking about in terms of revival.
Are you saying that the trial court did not have jurisdiction to allow to enter the judgment going back to the 1977?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And I take it that's the basis for your claim that this was a void judgment?
Yes. That is correct, Your Honor.
And that's why no motion to vacate that judgment had been made within 2 years of having the judgment mailed to the house?
Your Honor, with all due respect, we believe that, first of all, there is no notice requirements on a verified entry of support judgment. That is very clear in the statute. So we believe, with all due respect, that that argument made by the appellee is in a sense a smokescreen. And if I can give an example, if Mr. Brookins had died and Mrs. Brookins had pursued enforcing a verified entry of support judgment, and the estate had no knowledge of that verified entry of support judgment, and that support judgment covered judgments that had not been revived within the 20-year time period, we would contend that those judgments that had not been properly revived were void. They are the judgment, the statute on enforcement of judgment says they are deemed satisfied. So we would contend that whether it was 2 years, no matter what time frame it was, there was no notice requirements. And the bottom line is that the court has no subject matter jurisdiction. Those judgments are void and they don't exist. That's our contention about
it. You're saying it's a matter of jurisdiction.
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. I would point out again, and again, this is not a clear issue. I wouldn't be standing here today. The case law indicates, I've cited the Houck v. Shuck decision, which is Colorado Supreme Court, the Levitt v. Smith decision, which is a Court of Appeals 1987, and then the Santorelli decision from 1992, which is from the Court of Appeals as well. In all of those decisions, the court stated very clearly the statutory period for enforcement of each installment of support begins to run from the due date of each installment. That is very clear, and we contend that that's when the time would have started running for the revival of judgments in this particular case. Your Honor, I would also like to point out that in the Santorelli decision, which both parties rely on, interestingly, the court in that decision cited another case, In Re Marriage of, I think you say, Schutte. It's a Court of Appeals case from 1986. That also was an action by an ex-wife to reduce to judgment child support arrears. The issue in that case that came up was, when does interest on those support payments accrue? And the court in that case held that interest on support judgments begins to accrue from the date each judgment of child support becomes a final money judgment. Your Honors, I would suggest from that a final judgment is a final judgment for all purposes. It's for interest, it's for the running of the 20 years on the revival statute, it covers everything. And the fact that that decision was referenced in the Santorelli decision, to me, provides additional support to the fact of the time frame of when the 20-year time starts running for revival of statutes. So, Your Honors, on that particular issue, it is our contention, based upon the plain language of 1410.122.1c, 54H, which is referenced in that statute, which talks about the process for reviving statutes and references the 20 years. The statute 1352.102.2a, which is about execution on judgments. All of those and the case law on this very issue supports the principle that the 20-year time for revival of judgments starts running when each installment is due and not paid and becomes a final money judgment.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's all I have at this time. Thank you.
Saved about 4 minutes and 47 seconds.
That's right. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Michael Zweibel. I represent the appellee in this matter, Mary Lou Brookins. For clarity, mostly in my own mind, I'll refer to her as the wife and to Mr. Brookins as the husband. Your Honors, before we get to the substantive question in this case, the real first question is whether the 60B3 motion was timely and whether the substantive arguments raised ought to be considered at all. And I think as the court's questions have, I think, shown or indicated, that comes down to a question of whether the 20-year statute of the 20-year limitations period is a statute of limitations, which in a civil case is not jurisdictional, or whether it is a jurisdictional bar. And frankly, I think that question is answered by a series of cases that were cited by the by husband in the reply brief when they first addressed this issue of timeliness. Those are the cases of first Mark v. Mark, and then followed by Robbins v. Goldberg, the Supreme Court case that overruled Mark v. Mark. In Mark v. Mark, the trial court had issued an order after the 20-year period had passed, even though the party had requested revival within the 20-year period. And the court held, well, the 20-year period that's contained in Rule 54 is jurisdictional. So when the order was entered, the court was without jurisdiction to enter it, and so the order is void. That was rejected in Robbins v. Goldberg. Robbins v. Goldberg said the time of filing is crucial, whether it's filed within the 20-year period. And the way they got to that conclusion was by analyzing the 20-year period as a statute of limitations, where the filing is what triggers, the running of the limitations period and not the entry of the order. They rejected, although I have to say that Robbins v. Goldberg, it's a rather brief opinion, and it's not in so many words, but they analyze it as a statute of limitations. They do not analyze it as a jurisdictional bar. And so that really, I think, is the state of the law on whether it's a statute of limitations or a jurisdiction.
How about Santarelli, where they clearly say it's void after 20?
They do. And the interesting thing is that in Robbins v. Goldberg, if we look at footnote 2 of Robbins v. Goldberg, they address Santarelli. And they say, well, Santarelli adopted some of the reasoning of Mark v. Mark. And they don't say exactly what it is. They say, but that was dictum. And so we don't need to address it here. Otherwise, we essentially, I don't have it in front of me, but essentially they say the only reason we're not overruling Santarelli is because that adoption of the Mark v. Mark reasoning was in dictum. And the only thing that Santarelli cites Mark v. Mark for is exactly that language that Your Honor just referred to, which is that it's void after the 20 years. And so I think, again, I wish Robbins v. Goldberg were a lot more straightforward and a lot clearer in explaining what they meant. But I think looking at the analysis they used, which is they analogized Rule 54 to a statute of limitations, and then looking at footnote 2, where they said we would overrule Santarelli if it wasn't dictum for its adoption of Mark v. Mark, they clearly meant to reject the analysis of the 20-year period as a jurisdictional bar.
It looked to me like Robbins was maybe a little more narrow. I think what they said was where the motion is filed in such period amount of time that the court could have resolved it before the 20 years was ended, we're not going to penalize the person who filed just because of court delays. And I think they were basing that on sort of equitable grounds. They would not necessarily come out the same way if it had been filed the day before the time period expired. So I'm not sure I see it as fully as a jurisdictional issue. I think they were exercising their equitable powers and saying, look, if you get your thing filed on time, and then the court just dills around and doesn't get it resolved, we're not going to hold that against you. And so I'm not quite following you say that establishes a more broad jurisdictional premise that overrules the issue we're talking about.
Well, I think, you know, the thing about jurisdictional bars is that they're absolute. I don't think they can be overcome on equitable grounds. If a court loses jurisdiction, it just loses jurisdiction. And so the only way to even analyze it in that fashion is to say this is not a jurisdictional bar. And in fact, the way they analyze it is specifically by analogizing it to statutes of limitations. That's how they get there. They say that in statutes of limitations, the date of filing is what's important, and so too here. And I think that mode of reasoning shows the court's recognition that they can't just call it, say that it is a jurisdictional bar, but then also overcome it on equitable grounds. It has to be something other than a jurisdictional bar. And I think the reasoning shows that they were treating it as a statute of limitations. I would also point out that in Houck v. Shuck, which husband relies on quite a bit, 1352-102, which at that time was 77-1-2, is referred to as a statute of limitations. Now, I don't know that that's dispositive, because I don't know if that question was before the court, is this jurisdictional bar, is this a statute of limitations? But they clearly refer to it as a statute of limitations. And
why can't the Robbins case be viewed as filing is the trigger for the jurisdictional prerequisite?
Because the court, well, I hadn't thought of it that way, but I don't think it can, because a jurisdictional bar where a time limit is reached and the court loses jurisdiction, it really doesn't matter what has gone on before that. You can't say...
Well, wait a second. Isn't there something that triggers a court's jurisdiction? If you invoke the court's jurisdiction, you don't, in timely, you don't lose it thereafter. If you do something to trigger the court's jurisdiction timely, you don't lose it thereafter.
I agree with that, but that's not the way the court analyzed it in Robbins. The court analyzed it, and I wish Robbins were a longer opinion. I wish Robbins had engaged in more analysis. But again, I don't have it in front of me, but I remember it was under Head Note 2 is where they engaged in that analysis. Where they clearly analogized the 20-year period to a statute of limitations. I don't know if they would have done that if they meant to analyze it in terms of jurisdiction.
You know how this is treated in other places in the country?
I don't.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know how it's treated in other places in the country. I'm sorry. The Houck v. Shuck identification as a statute of limitations is something that's really followed through on in later cases. The Gross case from the Court of Appeals, much later than that, quotes from Houck v. Shuck and again refers to it as a statute of limitations. I think the only place you find any reference to it as a jurisdictional bar is Mark v. Mark, which was overruled. And I think it would be something of a stretch to say that the case was overruled, but its underlying reasoning, which was clearly different than the reasoning employed in Robbins v. Goldberg, somehow remains intact. So I would suggest that this is a statute of limitations, that the court did not have, the court properly rejected the Rule 60b-3 motion as untimely. And for that reason, I think that really resolves the issue. Now, if we're to get to the substantive issue, I do agree with Ms. Robbins on one thing. I think that is, in my mind, a much closer issue because of the ambiguous language of 1410.122. Specifically, its reference to Rule 54. What does it mean when it refers to Rule 54? What does it mean when it says all judgments contained in a verified motion for a verified entry for support judgment are revived pursuant to Rule 54? First, it says all, and then it says pursuant to Rule 54. I think all means all. I think they would have said something different if they meant not all. And I think the reference to Rule 54 was meant simply to say, this is our revived judgments in the sense of Rule 54, rather than we are adopting all of the procedural requirements of Rule 54. And one of the ways we know that is that they dispense specifically with the motion, notice, and hearing requirements of Rule 54. So they don't mean to adopt the procedural requirements of Rule 54. And so there's nothing in there to indicate they meant to adopt the 20-year limit. In fact, they say all judgments, really the language is without limitation, all unpaid support judgments are revived when the verified entry is filed.
And I excuse me, counsel. So if wife lived for another 20 years and then she died and then her estate 10 years later were to bring an action, they could still enforce it going back to 1977. There's just no limit at all, is what you're saying.
Well, once the verified entry is filed, then that would have, under Santorelli, that would have to be revived within 20 years. But I think, and I can't obviously speak for the wisdom of the scheme that's adopted here. I mean, I just like the Robbins case, I wish the statutory scheme were a lot clearer than it actually is. But there are a few things in the statutory scheme that tell us they really did meet all. One is that no notice is required. If you were able to present a defense to this, like a statute of limitations defense, wouldn't they require notice? I mean, that's the purpose of notice in Rule 54. And so why would they have no notice? The other thing they say is that there's no enforceable judgment, essentially, until the verified entry is filed. Even though we have all these little judgments accumulating month by month by month, you can't enforce it unless you file a verified entry. That's when it becomes an enforceable judgment. And I think that's where the Santorelli case really comes in. I know both parties have cited it, apparently interpreting it differently, but what happened in Santorelli was in 1971, there was a fixed sum judgment entered for some payments going years before. Then in 1991, it was revived, and the husband said, you can't revive the judgments prior to 1971 because each one of them was a separate judgment going up until the time the fixed sum judgment was entered. And the court said, no, that's not true. The enforceable judgment essentially is the 1971 judgment. That's what triggers the 20-year period of revival, not the, simply the passage of each month without payment. It's the actual fixed sum judgment that triggers the 20-year period, and that's really consistent with, I think, the reading that I'm suggesting of 14.122. And unless the court has other questions, I think that's all I have today. Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, I do want to point out that support judgments for purposes of revival and enforcement are like any other kinds of judgments in terms of how the time period for revival. They don't get special treatment. But I do want to talk about a couple things that Mr. Zweibel talked about, which is the Santorelli decision. It's interesting, and I've spent a lot of time looking at the Santorelli decision. Mr. Zweibel did outline the facts appropriately. The ex-wife, interestingly, within 20 years of the accumulation of child support arrears, filed a judgment to reduce all those arrearages to a judgment. And then, so that became a judgment, all those arrears. Then, within 20 years after that, she filed a motion to reduce, she filed to reduce that revival judgment and then everything else that had accumulated for the next 20 years into a final judgment. And the court said that the first 20 years, that revived judgment could be incorporated into the entire judgment 20 years later. But what the court in Santorelli also said was they very specifically stated, make sure I quote it correctly, they went back to the same language that was in Houck v. Shuck, the Colorado Supreme Court case, Leavitt v. Smith. They said the statutory period for enforcement of each installment of support begins to run from the due date of each installment. That's consistent all the way through. What Mr. Zorbell is arguing is that any support, any unpaid support installments can become final judgments. And then from that, once they become an enforceable judgment, then the 20 years starts running. Don't believe that's what Santorelli said. I think they very clearly, well, they were willing to, and the issue didn't come up about the time frame of the first period of judgments that was entered. It was the second period. So I think that Santorelli states very clearly about this. And there's a little confusion in the language of it, but they do make very clear when the statutory period begins to run for each installment. The other thing is Santorelli is the Robbins decision. Sure, I'm saying this right. The Robbins decision references Santorelli in the holding in Mark, and they specifically say that it's dictum and that it's not necessary to overrule Santorelli. Well, what Santorelli said about the Mark decision was a revived judgment must be entered within 20 years after entry of the judgment which it revives. Otherwise, the court is without jurisdiction to affect such revival. That is the dictum in Robbins that was not overruled, even though it's dictum. So I want to point out that goes to the jurisdiction issue and the statute of limitations jurisdiction issue that that we're talking about. So
what about the analysis in Robbins? Mr. Zorbell says, you know, it's treated right down the line analogously to a statute of limitations.
Well, I believe that Robbins was a very narrow issue. I believe that it dealt with court delay on when a judgment was revived. It was filed within a certain period of time, and I believe that that was the very narrow issue. And I think that everything else, especially Santorelli, not overruling Mark on that particular issue, and also the issue of judgments, 1352-102-2A, states that judgments, enforcement of judgments that haven't been revived within the 20-year time frame are deemed satisfied. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted and we'll render a decision in due course.